On this Tuesday, July 7th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us, and here are some of your headlines. In just 1 week, the U.S. has seen another 380,000 new cases of coronavirus, the biggest surge in the South and Southwest. Cases are on the rise in a total of 37 states. The death toll in our country has now surpassed 130,000. In Florida alone, at least 44 hospitals have reached their capacity in the ICUs. That, according to the state health department, Arizona, Alabama, California, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Texas, all hitting record hospitalizations. This comes as Florida's education commissioner today ordering all schools in the state to reopen next month and to reopen 5 days a week. Meanwhile, Brazil's president has tested positive for COVID-19 after downplaying the threat. But President Bolsonaro says he is feeling, quote, very well. And coronavirus survivor actor Tom Hanks says we must all do our part to fight the virus, including wearing a mask. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin at the White House, where the president again making clear that a full reopening of the U.S. economy needs to include schools that are open for business. The president's remarks at an education roundtable to say that the nation is ready to send children back to school, despite that recent surge in coronavirus cases, especially in the South and in the West in California. More with President Trump.
So it's great to have you, and our First Lady and I are pleased to welcome everybody to this wonderful place and discuss the vital importance of safety and reopening America's schools. We want to reopen the schools. Everybody wants it. The moms want it. The dads want it. The kids want it. It's time to do it. You know, our mortality rate is right now at a level that people don't talk about, but it's down tenfold. So you look at deaths are way down from this horrible China virus. And it's a disgrace that it happened. Shouldn't have happened, but it did. And the economy is coming back, and it's coming back strongly. Jobs are setting records. For 2 months ago, they set the record. And then again, almost 5 million new jobs last month, which is a record. And it broke our last record of a month before. So the numbers are happening much faster than anybody anticipated. The stock market, NASDAQ, just hit another record today. And the markets generally are just really a very small amount below where they were at the height of the market when we first had to do this about 4.5, 5 months ago. And it's incredible what's happened. When you look at education, my administration has approved $13 billion for state and local education. We've approved over $6 billion to support colleges and another $6 billion in emergency grants to students, very importantly. We waived standardized testing requirements, deferred federal student loan and interest payments. So you take a look at the student loan program. We've waived student loan and interest payments, and that is something that people haven't been hearing about, and nobody talks about it, but it's a big deal. We've pioneered new treatments that are dramatically improving the health outcomes. Vaccines are doing very well. Therapeutics are doing very well. The therapeutic research has been incredible.
That from the president earlier today. According to Johns Hopkins University, which has been keeping track of COVID-19 since the outset, more than 36 million Americans have been tested for the virus. Globally, the death toll is approaching 540,000, with more than 11 million confirmed cases in nearly 200 countries around the world. At the education secretary at today's event earlier today, she spoke to a number of the nation's governors, and Betsy DeVos was critical of school districts that have not promised to fully reopen their schools this fall, going after those education leaders who won't accept the risk and, quote, gave up and did not try to launch summer instruction. And during that call with the governor, she took particular aim at Fairfax County, Virginia, in the school district just outside of Washington, D.C., in what she called a distance learning disaster this spring. And now that school offering a choice of only online or 2 days a week of in-person instruction moving forward in the fall. Meanwhile, the city of Melbourne, Australia, has imposed a new lockdown of 6 weeks to contend with a spike in coronavirus cases there. The numbers indicate that there are now more than 11.5 million cases worldwide. And as we said just a moment ago, nearly 540,000 people have died. Just some of the issues discussed during an Atlantic Council forum that was held earlier today. And among the participants, Dr. Deborah Birx, she is a member of the White House Task Force on Coronavirus, offering this assessment of where the U.S. is and why we're seeing such an uptick in so many communities around the country.
In the United States, we are very independent people. Each of our states are different. Each of our counties are different. Each of our metros are different. And you can see that now in the pandemic in the United States. The pandemic originally, like when it hit Italy and Lombardy region, it hit really very much in the Northeast, Chicago, Detroit, and New Orleans. And much of the rest of the country was spared. And I think many of the governors and mayors thought they would be forever spared through this. And so as they opened and began to see small cases, they were used to responding immediately to outbreaks and stopping the outbreak. And I think none of us really anticipated the amount of community spread that began in really our 18 to 35-year-old age group. And I think this is an age group that was so good and so disciplined through March and April. But when they saw people out and about on social media, they all went out and about. And so we right now have really significant cases in people under 45. We're working very hard to protect those we know are most vulnerable. We're working very hard right now with every governor and every mayor to increase in flood testing into the areas, to be able to really isolate individuals and isolate entire households, and making sure that we're protecting the most vulnerable neighborhoods with through testing and isolation. And then working very hard with our hospitals to ensure better outcomes. And like many people, we see a really dramatic decline in our case fatality rates. And this is really because of the work that the Europeans did to teach us, the work that the UK did in providing the information on steroids, and the work that we're doing here in the United States to make remdesivir, important therapeutic, convalescent plasma, and now the studies we're doing with monoclonal antibodies.
That virtual forum hosted by the Atlantic Council and the comments of Dr. Deborah Birx, who is a key member of the White House Task Force on Coronavirus. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting on one teenage victim of coronavirus. Quote, at just 17 years old, Carson Lee Davis had already experienced more challenges than most people face in their entire lives. From the age of 2, she battled a number of health issues, including cancer and a rare autoimmune disorder. A medical examiner's report recently made public, however, has raised questions about Carson's case. The Miami-Dade County Medical Examiner finding that the immune-compromised teenager went to a large church party with roughly 100 other children where she did not wear a mask and social distancing was not enforced. The story goes on to write that then after getting sick, nearly a week passed before she was taken to the hospital. And during that time, her parents had given her hydroxychloroquine, that anti-malarial drug that was touted by the president, that the Food and Drug Administration has issued warnings about, saying usage could cause potentially deadly heart rhythm problems. You can get more details on her case, the 17-year-old victim of COVID-19. It's available online tonight at WashingtonPost.com. Well, earlier today, White House trade advisor Peter Navarro bashing what he called the hydroxy hysteria during a gaggle with reporters at the White House, claiming the media has been against the drug ever since President Trump spoke positively about it. This is what he told reporters.
Yesterday, the four doctors at the Detroit hospital system, led by William O'Neill, filed a request for an emergency use authorization for the medicine known as hydroxychloroquine. The request to the FDA was for three things. One, for early treatment use in a hospital setting. Number two, treatment between a doctor and his patient in an outpatient setting. And three, not just as a therapeutic, but also as a possible prophylaxis for preventative use. This request to the FDA comes on the heels of the publication of their study in the Journal of Infectious Diseases last week that showed an astonishing 50% reduction in the mortality rate for patients taking hydroxychloroquine, a 50% reduction. But importantly, the study was based on what's called early treatment. And the science of this is pretty simple. If you look at kind of a 14-day arc of the virus from the beginning of symptoms to the time you might be in an ICU setting on a ventilator, the first 7 days are critical. They're the days in which you may have a fever, a dry cough, possibly a profound sense of fatigue. At that point, your lungs are still intact, and the virus is not appreciably spread to the rest of your organs. Hydroxychloroquine, based on the science in articles like the one that originally appeared in 2005 in the Journal of Virology, works in a therapeutic way by raising the alkalinity of your cells, which slows the replication of the virus and also can kill the virus.
That from the president's trade ambassador talking drugs at the White House earlier today and drug treating COVID-19. The full statement available on our website at cspan.org. Actor Tom Hanks is a survivor of coronavirus. He spoke about his illness for the first time at length during a Today Show appearance this morning. His condition included crippling body aches, fatigue, and often a lack of concentration. And he questioned why some Americans still do not take this pandemic seriously.
The idea of doing one's part, though, should be so simple. Mm-hmm. Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands. Mm-hmm. That alone means you are contributing to the betterment of your house, your work, your town, your society as a whole. And it's such a small thing. And it's a mystery to me how somehow that has been wiped out of what should be ingrained in the behavior of us all.
Yeah.
Simple things. Do your part.
Yeah, it does seem basic. How do you think the country's responded, Tom?
Well, I think a huge majority of Americans get it. There's no law against ignorance. It's not illegal to have opinions that are wrong. I think you flout a number of realities when two and two don't add up to four. Granted, this is a mysterious thing where, you know, eight people are asymptomatic. They don't know they have it. They don't feel bad. There's all sorts of things that come along in it. But there is a darkness on the edge of town here, folks, and it is. Let's not confuse the fact. It's killing people. Okay, you can argue what the numbers are. It's not killing that many. The numbers have gone down, et cetera. Yeah, that's right. It's killing people. And you can say, well, you know, traffic accidents kill an awful lot of people too. Traffic accident happens because a lot of drivers aren't doing their part. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not using their turn signals. They're mm-hmm. driving too fast. They're not paying attention to their environment. I don't know how common sense has somehow been put in question in regards to this.
Yeah, I can tell you're passionate about this one because I know.
I'm just an American who's getting by in the course of the day.
Just part of the conversation earlier today on NBC's Today Show with actor Tom Hanks, who has survived COVID-19. Meanwhile, the Senate's Republican leader is back in his home state of Kentucky with an eye on his own reelection effort and dealing with coronavirus. During a series of events, Senator Mitch McConnell saying he is open to another stimulus package, but a package that needs to include a second stimulus check for Americans is a possibility. In Louisville yesterday, here is what he said.
I said after the last CARES Act passed in March that we'd take another look at it in July. So the second part of where do we go from here, everybody should be wearing a mask. That's what each of us can do to be helpful. And we will be taking a look at in the Senate in a couple of weeks, another package based upon the conditions that we confront today. We've been pleased at the number of jobs that have come back. There is an indication the economy is likely to come back, but there's still challenges. For us to have a normal situation across the country, it seems to me the next package, if there is one, and I believe there will be one, must contain the following. Number one, liability protection. And this is not just for businesses. This is for hospitals, doctors, nurses, nonprofits, universities, colleges, K through 12, so that people who acted in good faith during this crisis are not confronted with a second epidemic of lawsuits in the wake of the pandemic that we're already struggling with. Unless you were grossly negligent or intentionally engaging in harmful conduct, you should be protected from liability during this process. Why is that necessary? As of a couple of weeks ago, there were already 1,100 lawsuits filed, and there's an army of trial lawyers out there ready to take advantage of this situation. We cannot get back to normal if we have an epidemic of lawsuits.
That from the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell in Louisville, Kentucky yesterday. You might have heard some of those horns. There were demonstrators outside the venue. Now, as you heard just a moment ago, for Senate Republicans to approve that bill, Senator McConnell again insisting it has to include a five-year liability shield for those businesses, as he outlined just a moment ago. White House economics reporter Jeff Stein is covering that part of the story. Earlier today, I asked him why that provision is key for GOP support.
But that's an important question, and it's become really a key sticking point as Congress begins to draft its next coronavirus stimulus package. Senate Republicans, led by Leader McConnell, have insisted on this liability shield that would insulate and protect primarily employers, but also healthcare providers, universities, schools, from being sued if someone goes there, gets coronavirus, or someone, one of their employees, gets sick and then later decides to sue. This is an issue that a lot of Democrats say is a big giveaway potentially to large businesses, many of whom have been criticized for not sufficiently implementing guidelines to protect their customers and workers, implementing CDC guidelines to this point remain advisory rather than mandatory. So this is something that McConnell says is necessary for getting the economy restarted. Democrats say could make the lives of workers and customers much more dangerous.
And to a larger point, the Senate Republican leader is facing at least some resistance among his GOP colleagues to spend any more money at all. So where does that stand?
So right now there's been an active debate, and I think even the Republicans who say that we should not do another package, even those Republicans will quietly admit and acknowledge that this is going to happen. The president has said that there needs to be another package. His top aides have been saying that for weeks, and McConnell himself has said that there needs to be another package. But what we're really seeing is the opening bids and the negotiations over how big it will be. And even sort of remarkably, the White House itself has been divided on this question. A senior aide to President Trump, Peter Navarro, said a few weeks ago that the president wants a price tag of over $2 trillion. Immediately after that, I was on the phone with other people in the administration, senior people in the White House, who said, no, we're going much closer to $1 trillion. And it's really highlighting some of these pre-existing divisions within the White House and within the administration between people who are more willing to spend and people who come from more sort of conservative Heritage Foundation Freedom Caucus backgrounds and are skeptical of that. But those divisions are going to make it very hard for McConnell and Trump to get this thing through with the full support of their caucus.
We're talking with Jeff Stein of The Washington Post. So what are the red lines for Democrats?
Democrats have been very clear and adamant that their top priority, at least many of the Democrats I've spoken to, that their top priority is extending the unemployment increase approved by Congress in the CARES Act in March. And that has been the subject of a lot of writing and debate, but effectively it said that everyone on unemployment due to the pandemic would receive an additional $600 per week subsidy on top of their original unemployment benefits. And now at this point, we have over 30 million Americans who benefit from that increase, and changing that, or at least eliminating it entirely, would amount to a reduction in income for over 30 million people. And a lot of economists I talked to are very worried about the impact that would have on aggregate demand and spending in the economy. Republicans have raised the concern that this unemployment benefit is so generous that it disincentivizes people from going back to work. But I would be shocked if Democrats voted for anything that did not include extension, at least in some part of that $600 increase. It might be $300, $400, maybe even $250, but they'll get something there for sure if they're going to vote for this. The other big thing I'll just mention quickly is that they have been adamant about the need for state and local aid money. States and cities are hemorrhaging cash and starting to lay off public employees. That could have a really dangerous ripple effect. We've seen massive contraction in public sector employment driven largely by states and cities shedding employees. And that, you know, when people's trash starts, you know, not getting picked up, that could be very dangerous and cause quite a public outcry.
Let's talk about the political reality of the calendar. The House and Senate in a two-week recess. They're back later this month. And then we're moving into the August recess and then the campaign season this fall. So what's the timeline to reach an agreement between both chambers and both parties?
So I think we're looking right now at the deal really maybe coming together in late July and early August. That's what they've said. But, you know, Congress moves very slowly in normal times. They move relatively quickly in March because of the scale of the crisis. But the idea that they'll be able to come back from this two-week recess with all the political headwinds they're facing and get something done before August strikes me as extremely unlikely. The list of things they need resolution on is staggeringly long. It's dozens and dozens of items as the pandemic continues to wreak havoc and cause enormous pain and suffering throughout the country. And as the country struggles to deal with both the public health and the economic side, Congress will face an enormous to-do list that even stretches beyond what do they do about the things that they approved in March that are about to fall off the cliff. And if they don't act, I mean, they have this sort of sword of Damocles hanging above their head. Congress approved over $1 trillion, I think it was about $1.5 trillion in additional federal spending that really stabilized the economy at this very difficult moment. And if they don't do anything, that number will shrivel quickly and will shrink to like less than $500 billion, less than $500 billion. So that is a real incentive for them to work and work fast. But, you know, you've been covering Congress for longer than I have, and you know that timeline that they set out is not always what they end up being able to meet.
Especially in this election year, not only for Congress, but for the president. We will follow your reporting at WashingtonPost.com. Jeff Stein, who covers White House economic issues, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Tuesday, July 7th. Here are some of your other headlines in politics. Utah's Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox has defeated former Governor John Huntsman for the GOP nomination in that state, ending Huntsman's comeback bid in the Republican primary. The AP declaring Cox the winner nearly a week after last Tuesday's primary, leading former Governor Huntsman 36% to 35%. John Huntsman won two gubernatorial elections back in 2004 and again in 2008 before leaving office to serve as President Barack Obama's ambassador to China. After his own ill-fated 2012 presidential campaign, President Trump tapping John Huntsman to serve as the U.S. ambassador to Russia. And the president's longtime political advisor, Roger Stone, mounting a last-ditch bid to get a federal appeals court to put off the 40-month prison sentence. Attorneys for Stone asking the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals for an emergency stay following U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson's ruling last week that puts Stone right now under house arrest. He's at his home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, directing him to report to federal prison camp next week, July 14th. During a speech here in Washington, FBI Director Christopher Wray laying out more details on the Chinese threat than the FBI has ever presented in an open forum. Those words from the FBI director. Axios.com writing the following, why it matters. China increasingly aggressive behavior under General Secretary Xi Jinping is ringing the alarm bells here in the U.S. A portion of the speech earlier today by the FBI director.
To understand this threat and how we must act to respond to it, the American people should remember three things. First, we need to be clear-eyed about the scope of the Chinese government's ambition. China, the Chinese Communist Party, believes it's in a generational fight to surpass our country in economic and technological leadership. Now, that's sobering enough, but it's waging that fight not through legitimate innovation, not through fair and lawful competition, and not by giving their citizens the freedom of thought and speech and creativity that we treasure here in the United States. Instead, China is engaged in a whole-of-state effort to become the world's only superpower by any means necessary. The second thing the American people need to understand is that China uses a diverse range of sophisticated techniques, everything from cyber intrusions to corrupting trusted insiders. They've even engaged in outright physical theft. And they've pioneered an expansive approach to stealing innovation through a wide range of actors, including not just Chinese intelligence services, but state-owned enterprises, ostensibly private companies, certain kinds of graduate students and researchers, and a whole variety of other actors working on their behalf.
That warning outlined in detail earlier today in a speech by the FBI director, Christopher Wray. In politics, half of the nation's electorate say that they have ruled out voting for President Trump in November, while 4 in 10 say the same about presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden. Joe Biden now holding a 12-point lead in the latest survey from Monmouth University, which was conducted between June 26th and June 30th. Questioning 867 registered voters, that survey has a 3.5% margin of error. According to The Economist's election forecast, Joe Biden has a roughly 9 in 10 chance of winning the Electoral College, and a staggering 98% probability of winning the popular vote in just 4 months. But Newsweek.com, with this warning, experts have said that there are indications that the former vice president does not have the race in the bag yet, opening him up to the possibility of an upset loss akin to Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. That part of the story at Newsweek.com. Both campaigns out with a new set of ads. We begin with this from the Biden campaign.
There's so many unsung heroes in each of our communities, especially in times of crisis. Some we encounter every day. Alasan has been working at a local grocery store in Ohio for 6 years. Every day he's serving others by stocking those shelves, taking inventory, making sure his store is ready for the next day. Because of the supply shortage, he was working without PPE and he put his life on the line to make sure his community was fed.
We had no choice. We had to do it for our community. Even though it's a rough situation, it definitely puts a smile on my face.
Want to find a hero in America? They're all around us. Alasan is one of them.
You have reached the 911 police emergency line. Due to defunding of the police department, we're sorry, but no one is here to take your call. If you're calling to report a rape, please press 1. To report a murder, press 2. To report a home invasion, press 3. For all other crimes, leave your name and number, and someone will get back to you. Our estimated wait time is currently 5 days. Goodbye.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
Some of the latest ads from the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign. Meanwhile, a Republican anti-Trump group has released a new video ad telling the president that he cannot rely on anyone's loyalty and that even his family is, quote, whispering about him. This new ad from the Lincoln Group.
Biden now leads the president.
He's going to be your president.
Why do you think you're losing, Donald?
Because some people don't love me, maybe.
It's because you've got a loyalty problem.
Loyalty problem.
They're in your campaign.
They're in your campaign.
Your White House.
Your White House.
In Congress.
In Congress.
Even your own family.
Your own family.
They whisper about you.
They whisper about you.
They leak, spin, lie. They tell the media they're smart and you're out of control.
And you're out of control.
That you can't focus.
Can't focus.
That you're mentally and physically weak.
Physically weak.
That you hide in your bunker.
Scared
and shaky.
Shaky.
Laugh when you can't walk down a ramp or drink water. All of them.
They're in your campaign.
The ones you know and the ones you don't know.
The ones you don't know.
Whispering about you.
Whispering about you. The ones you don't know.
They expect you to lose.
They expect you to lose.
They want the media to like them and to get one last big payday before you go down.
Go down.
With so many leaks, you probably think it could be anyone.
So many leaks.
Donald.
It could be anyone.
It's everyone.
It's everyone.
Just some of the ads now on the air in campaign 2020. And one of the other looming questions this summer, what will the party conventions look like next month? Holly Otterbein is following that story for Politico. And more questions than answers this evening.
So Democratic officials announced recently that the Milwaukee convention would be extremely scaled back and delegates should not attend it. And so one idea that's been floated as an alternative is holding mini conventions across the country, especially in battleground states where delegates in those states and party leaders can gather. But now, as we see, surges of coronavirus again in several states like California and Texas and many others, some Democrats are asking themselves, should they even do that? Is that safe?
And of course, another hotspot is in Florida. Jacksonville is the site of the Republican convention or gathering after the business session in Charlotte, North Carolina. And a number of Republican senators, including Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, saying they will skip the convention for health and safety reasons.
Yeah. So Representative Ro Khanna, who is the leader of the California Democratic delegation, he said, "We should think, what would Dr. Fauci do?" And he doubts that Dr. Fauci would do mini conventions, that he'd be okay with it. He said it will backfire to be, quote, aggressive like the Republicans are. I talked to the leader of the Pennsylvania Democrats, who said that she didn't think that mini conventions would likely work because of the pandemic. Some DNC members said it would not be wise to gather anywhere in person. So similar to the Republicans, some Democrats are having second thoughts about their current plans for the convention.
Is there a plan B for the Republicans? Because the president has said repeatedly he wants a large gathering, a more typical convention. But of course, this is not a typical summer.
Yeah, he really wants to have that big convention speech where there's a huge crowd and there's balloons dropping and everything is like normal. But I think even Republicans at this point, many of them acknowledge, at least privately, that the convention is likely not going to be like that, and that it might end up actually being closer to what the Democrats are doing, where it's a drastically scaled down convention. Some Democrats think actually that the fact that it's scaled down might be unfortunate, but it could play with voters because it will make them look like the more responsible party if they have a very scaled back convention with very few people in Milwaukee and Republicans, pretend that COVID is not happening.
The reporting of Holly Otterbein, her work available at Politico.com. We thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
On Wall Street, stocks retreating today, the Dow losing nearly 400 points, the NASDAQ down 89, and the S&P was off almost 34 and a half. The president's top advisor on trade, Peter Navarro, claiming during an interview that he's race blind because he's from California, where people don't see race. Navarro telling CNN that his, quote, awakening on the issue came when he was 8 years old, visiting a segregated Woolworth store in West Palm Beach, Florida. Business Insider pointing out that according to the latest U.S. Census figures in California, it is 39% Latino, 37% white, 15% Asian American, and 6% black. Here is part of that interview earlier today.
I do want to ask you, because this is important, another important subject to a lot of Americans.
I would let Kaylee speak for herself.
I understand. Kaylee would not articulate what the White House position is on Confederate flags flying at NASCAR.
Do you understand
what the White House position is?
This is not my lane, John. I'm here to save lives and create jobs.
But part of your lane is, I'm not
the press secretary. I'm really not.
How do you feel personally? You don't want to condemn the Confederate. You don't have feelings about the Confederate flag?
Here's John. Let me tell you a personal story, if I may. Okay. My awakening on the race issue was when I was 8 years old in a Woolworth store in West Palm Beach, Florida, when I walked over and I took a drink from the colored water fountain because I wanted to see colored water. Mm-hmm. And this woman came up to me and just gently said, "You can't drink from that." And I go, "Why?" She says, "That's for colored people." And it was like, "Oh yeah, I'm 8 years old." And that didn't make any sense to me. And so none of this race
sure.
racial divisions have made any sense to me. And, you know, I'm a Californian. We don't see race out there. So, you know, it's like I live my life in,
the president,
in a race-blind world.
It's the president who brought
and
up the flag.
It troubles me.
It's the president who brought up the flag yesterday.
It troubles me that we have so much of this discussion when, in fact, we've got real problems in this country.
That's a real problem.
It is a real problem. It is a problem. But what I'm telling you, John, I go back to what I said. Right now, here's another issue. Why is it that more black people died in Chicago from gunshots than the China virus?
Is it because of the Confederate flag?
In Chicago? Come on, that's the most Democratic. Barack Obama's, Michelle Obama's, and Rama.
I'm asking you a question about the flag.
You're drawing me in.
I'm asking you a question about the flag. You're telling me Chicago.
This is the cancel culture kind of idea where everybody's got to go through one of your litmus tests.
Nope. I'm talking about the president's tweet about the flag.
Hydroxychloroquine and saving jobs and lives.
All right.
That exchange earlier today with John Berman on CNN and Peter Navarro, who is the president's top trade advisor. His comments are available online at CNN.com. A new book by Donald Trump's niece, Mary Trump, describing the president, quote, as a person likely affected by multiple psychological disorders who is profoundly unsuited to be president of the United States. As background, Mary Trump is the daughter of the president's older brother, Fred Trump Jr. He was an airline pilot who suffered from alcoholism. He died of a heart attack at the age of 42. She was 16 at the time. Today, she is a clinical psychologist who holds a PhD from Adelphi University in New York. Among the claims in her book, she accuses the president of paying a friend to take the SAT for him when he was applying for college as a teenager. She also alleges that Donald Trump's older sister, Marianne Trump Barry, often did his homework for him during high school, which helped him get into the University of Pennsylvania. Back in 2015, Marianne Trump Barry saying that her brother had, quote, no principles, none, and that the only time Donald went to church was when the cameras were there, calling it, quote, mind-boggling. On the day of the president's older brother Fred was dying in the hospital, that was in 1981, Donald Trump and his sister Elizabeth went to the movies, she claims, no one from the family accompanying her father to the hospital. And she alleges that Donald Trump's father often used anti-Semitic language. On Fox News earlier today, White House counselor Kellyanne Conway had this reaction to the new book from the president's niece.
What's your reaction or the reaction from the White House to this book that's coming out?
I'll say a few things. One is that Marianne Trump Barry, the president's sister and the president, have a great relationship as far as I can see, meaning she came to the inauguration almost 2 years after the announcement. And I believe family matters should be family matters. I think the thin-skinned, troubled, living in glass house mainstream media members who think people's families are their business ought to really think thrice the next time they do that. This is like every other book out there, in my view, which is we imbue instant credibility onto anybody, especially those not under oath and writing works of fiction, perhaps, or fiction within a work of fiction, as long as they're out there to get the president. I think reporters ought to focus on getting the story and not getting the president. That's what they're supposed to be doing.
From Fox News earlier today, Kellyanne Conway, the book by Mary Trump is titled Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, set for release next week on July 14th by publisher Simon & Schuster. Well, the Miami Herald has this headline tonight. Trump is heading to the coronavirus capital of Florida. Will he wear a mask? He's going down to visit the U.S. Southern Command in Doral, also holding a fundraiser in Broward County. It also places the president at the center of Florida's coronavirus outbreak in Miami-Dade County. CNN's Caitlin Collins with this question to White House counselor Kellyanne Conway.
The wise advice for the president to go, a huge contingent of aides, Secret Service agents. Why is that wise to send all of those people into a hospital?
We have an important message for the world, and especially the drug cartels, and really the people in our different communities, Caitlin, that we are doing everything we can under tough circumstances and having inherited from an administration that did little to nothing to disrupt the flow of narcotics. We're doing everything we can, particularly knowing that most of these illicit drugs come through Mexico or from China, et cetera. And he's going there. I mean, he and the vice president are the two most essential workers in the country, so they are tested regularly, and the people around them are tested regularly. We are people who come to the safely reopening the schools today will have been tested before they can be near the president, the vice president, and their spouses. So we're, you know, in a little bit of a bubble down at Southcom, and we can't just stop. Just like the country can't stop what it's doing, we can't stop what we're doing. He's got to run a nation, and I do.
Literally raging with coronavirus.
Could he do it by teleconference? Was that considered? Was there any other alternate to do it, to going to Florida with that many people, given what happened in Tulsa and what's happened elsewhere?
I mean, Philadelphia is a hot spot for lots of things. Did you think that it was worth Joe Biden, who is probably an at-risk patient, looks like to me, but since we're talking about doctor, non-medical people giving diagnoses, let me put mine in. Did you worry about his safety? Or, I mean, what if he got his spittle? What if his spittle, excuse me, what if Biden's spittle had gone beyond the teleprompters and everybody there was at risk? They're not being tested. He said he hasn't had, he said he hasn't had a COVID test. So we at least know the rest of us are not infected.
We'll share that with our teams to cover him.
He said he's, well, I'm worried about them because while they're throwing softball questions at Joe Biden, they don't know if they're getting infected. He said he's been tested for cognitive function, amen, but not for COVID.
And that from Kellyanne Conway with White House reporters earlier today. And finally, it was 90 years ago today, work began on the Hoover Dam. And then over the next 5 years, with 21,000 workers producing what would end up being the largest dam of its time. Back in 2016, C-SPAN Cities Tour showcasing the Hoover Dam, we spoke to Rose Davis, the public affairs officer for the Department of the Interior at the time.
Hoover Dam was actually started in 1931 in April. The contractors were given 7 years to complete it, and they actually got it done in 5 years. When the federal government decided to authorize Hoover Dam and fund it, it took literally six different construction companies to come together with their resources to have enough stuff, machines, manpower to put this together. So you'll see the signs around Hoover Dam that it was built by six companies, because that's actually how many it took, and they joined forces to build this beautiful place. Totally, there was about 21,000 men that worked on the dam. At its peak, towards the end, about 1934, there were 5,000 workers that were here working. The workers worked 24/7. They had 2 days off a year that they could take. It was voluntary. And you ask a lot of people, and a lot of people, you ask them what those days were. Everybody gets Christmas, but the other day that they could take off was the 4th of July. That's how proud they were of this structure.
Some background on Hoover Dam construction, which officially began on this day 90 years ago. The dam built along the Colorado River, providing not only flood control and crop irrigation, as well as hydroelectric power for the southwestern states, but also a number of jobs in the area, especially around Las Vegas. You can find the entire program on our website at cspan.org. And a reminder, this program is also available as a podcast, also on our website. You can check it out or download it wherever you get your favorite podcast. A reminder to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully for this Tuesday. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your evening.